From KUAZ News in Tucson, I'm Julie Bierock, and this is Arizona Spotlight. The deadline to sign up for the Medicare prescription drug program is fast approaching. We'll have a report on what seniors need to know. A new documentary called Tucson Remembers the War Years will air next week on KUAT Channel 6. We'll talk with the director and editor of the film, which explores the experiences of Tucsonans during the years of the Second World War. Retired Bishop Manuel Moreno was buried this week. We'll have a feature story on the funeral services that were held and a look back on his life. Those stories and more coming up. But first, the holidays are coming up, and that means lots of things to get done. But if you're Medicare eligible, there's one thing to think about: prescription drug coverage. Christopher Conover has more.
Medicare eligible senior citizens are facing a deadline. They have until the end of the year to sign up for or make any changes to the so-called Part D coverage, which is the prescription drug plan. But Jeff Belligan with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services says you really need to sign up by the 8th of December.
By signing up by the 8th of December, and that is by either choosing a new plan or by enrolling for the first time, the beneficiary will be assured of January 1 being able to go to the pharmacy and have his or her medications in that pharmacy system.
For eligible seniors, there are plenty of options, and that does cause some problems, according to Stuart Grable with the Pima Council on Aging.
Forcing 85-year-olds, people with dementia, people who have difficulty making choices, it puts a lot of pressure on them at a time when they really don't need that pressure.
This is the second year of the Medicare prescription drug plan, and advocates for seniors say there are certain problems with it. For example, the so-called donut hole. That's the gap in coverage when seniors' prescription costs reach just over $2,000. At that point, the Medicare recipient has to pay 100% of the drug cost until their bills reach $3,600. All the while, they still have to pay premiums for their chosen drug plan, according to Grable.
Our agency gets complaints, so naturally we would hear more of the problems than the things working well. But we are still getting complaints about people who are in the donut hole, that the cost of their medications are higher than they thought they would be, definitely higher than they could get if their drug is on the list at Walmart or Target or one of the $4 discount places. So we're looking at a plan that says it's doing really well, but the seniors we see are not as happy with it.
Premiums on a number of the plans are going up this year also, and while Social Security payments are also rising, the Pima Council on Aging, Stuart Grable, says that doesn't necessarily help.
Depends really on the individual, what your Social Security benefits are. Social Security does go up every year, but the amount that the co-payments and the deductibles have gone up eat into that, because it's not just Part B, Part D, it's also Part B. The premiums have gone up, and the co-payments for all of those things have gone up. So for some seniors, it is a wash. For some seniors, it's more out of pocket, depending on how many drugs they need and what their co-payments are.
So how do you know if you need to make a change to your current plan? Jeff Belligan with HHS says seniors need to look at their prescription needs.
CMS has encouraged people to go over their list of medications to check their plan cost to see if they've changed any of their medications and if they'd like enhanced benefits. That is, do they consider having coverage within the so-called donut hole? Do they want a policy with no deductible? Do they want a different form of drug, that is generic or preferred brand, if they indeed choose gap coverage? Those are the questions they need to ask themselves.
The Pima Council on Aging's Grable says there's one other thing to keep in mind.
If you had coverage and it worked for you last year and you have the same available to you this year, then you can sit back.
As of the last official tally, Jeff Belligan says most Medicare-eligible seniors are signed up for the Part D prescription plan.
We have now enrolled 90% of all Medicare beneficiaries in some sort of drug coverage plan. That is 38.3 million people out of the estimated 42.5 million that have Medicare.
Meanwhile, the staff at the Pima Council on Aging says right now they're dealing with 30 to 40 people a day with questions about the prescription drug plan. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Christopher Conover.
Up next on Arizona Spotlight, remembering former Bishop of Tucson, Manuel Moreno. This is Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. This week, Tucson Catholics bid farewell to a man who served them for 21 years, Bishop Emeritus Manuel D. Moreno. He died Friday, November 17th, surrounded by his family and friends at his Tucson home. The rite of Christian burial was held over the course of 2 days, with 3,000 people attending services on Monday alone. On the following day, mourners filled St. Augustine Cathedral for his funeral mass to say goodbye to a man who was commonly described as quiet, humble, and pious. On a sunny Tuesday morning in downtown Tucson, the doors of St. Augustine Cathedral are adorned with black ribbon, a reflection perhaps of the mood inside, where over 1,000 mourners, including several local civic leaders, are gathered to pay their final respects to Manuel Moreno, the fifth bishop of Tucson. The Knights of Columbus Honor Guard, dressed in vibrant colors, swords drawn, line the aisle of the cavernous church. A horn sounds. And the dark wood casket containing the body of Bishop Moreno is escorted to the altar.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Cardinal Roger Mahoney of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles is presiding over the Mass. Also in attendance, 200 priests and 16 bishops, including current Tucson Bishop Gerald Kikanis, who worked closely with Moreno during his last few years as Bishop of the Diocese. He delivers the homily, of which the theme is, "You had to like Manny Moreno." He spoke of Moreno's humble and gentle demeanor.
You had to like Manny Moreno. Never rude, not pompous, not inflated, not seeking his own interest, not quick-tempered, not brooding over injury, but poor in spirit, meek, merciful, a peacemaker who hungered for justice.
Kikanis interjects humor when speaking of the man most would describe as possessing a childlike quality in his faith and having a penchant for UCLA, the Dodgers, Lakers, and mariachi music.
And his music caused some to pause. Little Joe and La Familia cranked up loud is what he liked. Who would have thought this quiet, gentle man. Tu amigo quiero ser, one of Little Joe's songs, said what Manny tried to live. I want to be your friend.
He was born Manuel Duran Moreno on November 27, 1930, in Placentia, California. The son of a Mexican farm worker, he was the first of five children. The Morenos were poor, but instilled in their children the value of hard work, culture, and faith. He went on to attend UCLA, where he earned a Bachelor of Science degree in Business Administration. In 1961, Manuel was ordained a priest for the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, and in 1977, elevated by Pope Paul VI to the episcopacy. He was the sixth Hispanic priest in the U.S. to be named a bishop. And in 1982, Pope John Paul II appointed him fifth bishop of Tucson. At a service Monday night, Moreno's nephew, Dominic Santana, recalled the day when Moreno was elevated to the level of bishop.
A level he did not expect or seek. Didn't feel like he deserved that. And my uncle didn't feel he deserved much, coming from a poor family. He didn't feel he deserved, and things were owed to him. He didn't feel that way.
His years as Bishop of Tucson were not without challenges, specifically the debt from the ownership of a television station and the scandals of sexual abuse of children by priests. From 1997 through 2001, 11 lawsuits were filed against the diocese, Bishop Moreno, priests of the diocese, and parishes by 16 plaintiffs, including 10 men who alleged sexual abuse by priests when they were children. The suits also alleged that Bishop Moreno and his predecessor, Bishop Green, had failed to report the abuse. When the lawsuits were settled in January 2002, Moreno publicly apologized to victims and their families. And in a homily at Our Mother of Sorrows Parish in February of that year, he asked forgiveness for his failings and committed the diocese to the safety of children, restoring trust, and helping victims of abuse heal. In his homily, Bishop Gerald Kakanis remarks on his strength and humility.
You had to like Manny Moreno. Seeing his perseverance, his determination to fix what was broken, to heal the deepest hurt, to get down on his knees and ask forgiveness. That takes a big man, a humble man, a holy man.
Moreno retired in 2003 due to health problems. He suffered from Parkinson's disease and prostate cancer. On November 12th, he suffered bleeding in his brain and was taken to a hospital in Phoenix where surgery temporarily stopped the bleeding. His wish was to die at home, so his family transported him back to Tucson on November 17th, where he died a few short hours later. As he lay dying, his family sang Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, God Bless America, and Come to the Table of Plenty. Close friend Monsignor Thomas Cahalane was there when he died. He recalled the Sunday when Moreno fell ill, and he administered the sacrament of the anointing of the sick.
After administering the sacrament, I asked him, I said, Bishop, are you at peace? And he said, yes, I am at peace. I rode with him in the ambulance to the emergency room at St. Joseph's Hospital. There it was soon determined that he needed to be air-vaced to Good Samaritan Hospital in Phoenix. After his stretcher was placed on the helicopter, I entrusted him again in prayer to our God of mercy and to Our Lady of Guadalupe. As the helicopter doors closed and it began to rise from its pad into the night sky and became a flickering light and then a disappearing light, I had an overwhelming sense that Bishop Moreno was entering into his final chapter of life.
At the conclusion of the Mass, Bishop Moreno's casket is escorted once again down the wide aisle of the cathedral. As the congregation sings the words of Salve Regina, they pray for the soul of their bishop, a man who will be remembered by most for drawing attention to the moral and social dimensions of the migration of Mexican citizens in the U.S. through Arizona, for supporting a culture of life, for persevering through difficult times, and most of all, his caring and humble spirit.
In peace, let us take our brother to his place of rest.
Manuel Moreno was 75 years old. Stay tuned to Arizona Spotlight. When we continue, we'll talk with the editor and director of the new documentary, Tucson Remembers, The War Years. It airs December 7th at 8 p.m. on KUAT Channel 6. You're listening to Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ.
So opposite of what a human being is about, because a human being wants to live, and a war is about death. I don't even think it's a question of bravery. I think it's a question of what the mind can accept and what the mind can't accept, and not everybody can accept those conditions. But I think most people who are trained can. That's an opinion, that's all. And I felt that I could, but that didn't make you any less frightened.
That's a man by the name of George Miller, telling his story in a new documentary called Tucson Remembers, The War Years. He's one of many men and women featured in the film that explores the lives and experiences of Tucsonans during the years of World War II. It'll air on KUAT Channel 6 on December 7th, the 65th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. The documentary was produced and directed by Tom Gillespie and Martine Rubio and edited by Steve Bayless. Tom and Steve join me now in our studios. Thanks for speaking with me.
Thank you for having us.
Well, in the documentary, you explore Tucson during the days of World War II, and you talk to many men who fought in the war and some women who also participated. Why did you want to make this film about Tucson and World War II?
I think that it's a very appropriate time to do a documentary about World War II. On a national level, it's been said that over 1,000 World War II veterans are dying every day. And indeed, if you look in the local obituaries, you can see that impact is happening in Tucson as well. So we have a unique opportunity to capture some of the memories that may be lost if we don't do it now or in the near future.
And how did you find the men and women that you interviewed in the film?
I found most of the men and women through word of mouth, through a lot of phone calls, from calling VFWs, cold calling them, asking if there was anybody at that VFW who had served in World War II, to some of the people at the Veterans Hospital were contacted people on our behalf. And also there are some fathers of friends of mine that served in World War II.
Steve, how long did it take to make the documentary from concept to completion?
Well, I think Tom was working on it for quite a while before we actually went into start videotaping the people talking about their experiences. But all told, I think it was 2 months, 2.5 months perhaps, from concept to completion, which is a really accelerated timeline. But we wanted to try and aim for this, you know, December 7th date, air date. So, you know, we did our best to get it done.
Well, you must have just had to work nonstop for two
yes.
and a half months.
Pretty much. We've been working on it for that amount of time. You know, there was the interviews to be done. Then there was culling through over 60, well, almost 70 hours of archival footage to try and find appropriate footage that would kind of go along with what they were talking about to represent what they were talking about.
One of the big parts of the documentary is the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941. What did you find? How did these men react to this first act of war?
Ed Grafe, the veteran who served in Pearl Harbor on the day of the attack, I believe responded according to how he's trained, and that's part of what allowed him to survive the attack.
I was on board USS Regal, and we were directly across from Battleship Row. I was on the fantail getting ready to make colors just a few minutes before 8 o'clock. But this time, we put the colors up in a hurry and got to our battle stations. They came in waves. The fighter planes came in first to make sure that we had no planes in the air, and then they strafed everything that was on the ground. And after the strafing runs, of course, the bombers came in, torpedo planes, and they were after the battleships. So battleships were the primary weapons of war then. And we got a few jet planes, of course, but nothing like the havoc that they caused. immediately after the bombing and the plane runs were over, we put our boats in the water and we were out picking up men out of the water, oil soaked, burned, harmed, damaged, and bringing them back in where they could get at and get worked on. And after that was done, then our crews went over and went into the battleships, and they cut the first hole in the bottom of the Oklahoma and went in to pull men out of there.
I think the people in Tucson that lived through that time all had interestingly similar experiences. The two of them were paperboys, and they were selling the same Arizona Daily Star paper. They couldn't get enough of them to sell them. Two of the people went to the same, went to Tucson High School and were at the same assembly when President Roosevelt asked for the declaration of war against Japan. So it was very interesting that many of their experiences were the same.
You also talked to a lot of women in the film about their experiences during the war, those who participated in the war and their experiences back here in Tucson. Can you talk about those women in the film?
It was very interesting to me to talk to both Mary and Sylvia, who served in the military during the war. They, I think, faced hurdles that a lot of men did not face.
Women were not really welcomed by a lot of the troops. We had monthly checks to make sure we weren't pregnant, for one thing. And yet, the best people in the world went in. 150,000 women served in the military in World War II.
I flew 5 different single-engine fighters, the 39, the P-40, the 47, the 51, and the 63, but I did not fly a twin engine. I don't think there's any question about it that we qualified in many more different planes. They qualified in the ones primary, basic, and advanced, and then whatever they flew overseas. And they might not get a chance to fly 5 or 6 other planes that we did fly. So we felt we were qualified on a lot more planes than they were.
You must have been an incredibly strong person to have to go through what they did to serve their country the way they did. In fact, Sylvia talks about how some people still to this day do not believe that she flew airplanes.
Well, I think what struck me most about the film was the enthusiasm and the passion in the way that these men and women spoke about their experiences and told their stories. It was like it happened yesterday. Is that the same sense that you got when you spoke with them?
In a lot of ways, I did. I think I was amazed with the majority of the people, their ability to recall minor details, what I would consider minor details, but which obviously had a huge impact on them, but also their ability to recall their feelings. I think a lot of people tend to forget those as time goes by. But those were some of the details that really struck me, is their ability to talk about how afraid they were, or how what good friends they had, or what their reaction was to some situation.
And their willingness to do so, because I'm sure a lot of that is deeply personal to them.
I think a lot of it was. There were certainly instances where a family member was in the room with us as we did the interviews, and they heard things that they had never heard before. Conversely, I know that there were lots of stories that were told to the family that were not shared with us. And you could see that a lot with particularly the people who fought in combat. It came to a certain point in a story where they would decline to go further, and they would not want to recall for us some of the horrible experiences that they must have seen and been through.
George Miller, who talks about the fact that he has those memories and at least once a day revisits those memories. I mean, I think what's amazing and fascinating about this project is that these are people who were there and experienced this firsthand. I mean, I've never been in combat before and have no idea what it's like. And I cannot imagine what these people went through. And you can just see it in their eyes.
Well, tell me about the process of making the documentary. Once you recorded the interviews and you got back to the studio, how did you sift through and how did you decide what stories made it into the film, what footage made it into the film? I'm sure that was pretty hard to do.
The process was compounded by the deadline for the airing of the production, in that it was hard to get most of our archival footage in time when the decisions were being made as to what part of the stories were going to be included and what parts were not. So we had to take into account that we may not be able to visually display a lot of what the stories were about. What I tried to do was to have some of the most personal stories from each of the people, as well as some of the most common experiences that people had. You know, the combat, which I thought would be a large part of the stories that were told, actually was a small part. But they talked about the training and about their feelings. That surprised me that was such a big part of it. It was certainly not our intention to tell the historical account of everything that happened in World War II, but more along the lines of what happened to some Tucsonans.
While making the film, did you find that Tucson was different from any other American town, American city, in their experiences with the war? Were we just kind of mimicking the sentiment of the country?
I think where Tucson may have differed more than a lot of places, and I think another reason for doing this documentary was the fact that Tucson really changed after the war because of all the people that came through here. The desert was a perfect place to train pilots, and as well as crews, that other combat people that would serve in deserts throughout the war. So because of Tucson being in the Sonoran Desert, a lot of people came through and then came back. They learned to fly here, or they were trained here or whatever, and they found out it was a pretty darn nice place to live, and they wanted to come back, and they made Tucson their permanent home after that.
Steve, the film is airing in high definition.
That's correct. We chose to do this project in high definition because that is the format of tomorrow, and we'll hopefully preserve these stories. I mean, these stories are being lost to us on a daily basis, and it's really important to get this on tape for our generation and for future generations.
Being from Tucson and making the film, did it change the way you change any of your feelings toward Tucson?
Well, one of the things that really surprised me about the process of doing this documentary was the fact that I learned how humble most of these people really were. There was a high school teacher when I went to Rincon that is in the film, and he was in D-Day, and I had no idea that he had gone through the things he had done. There was a pilot who was shot down behind enemy lines and spent 7 weeks behind enemy lines, who lived a half mile from where I grew up, and I used to go to his service station to get my air and my bicycle tires when I was a kid. And that, to me, just it made me even prouder of Tucson, but more importantly, I think proud of these vets, that they just went on with their lives, and certainly it affected them. But being from Tucson, it was very rewarding that these people had done what they did, and I had no idea until they shared their stories with us. And to me, it was very grounding that these people had done so much, and yet I didn't know about it until given the chance to ask them about it.
Mm-hmm. They certainly weren't seeking the notoriety.
Never.
The film is Tucson Remembers the War Years, airing on KUAT Channel 6 on December 7th. Tom, Steve, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
And now here's Mark McLemore with the Arizona Spotlight Arts Calendar.
This Sunday at 3 o'clock here on KUAZ, Tucson Remembers the War Years will be broadcast, a chronicle of World War II as related by Tucsonans whose lives were touched and changed by the conflict. The program makes its premiere on Channel 6 next Thursday, but hear the audio preview this Sunday at 3 o'clock here on KUAZ. For the holidays, this Saturday, the Tucson Symphony Orchestra String Quartet presents Javelina Holiday, Just for Kids. For Arizona Spotlight, this is Mark McLemore.
Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio from the University of Arizona and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood, with production assistance from Ginger Duran. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. A portion of the music heard on today's program was written and performed by Calexico. Audio archives of Arizona Spotlight programs are available online at kuaz.org. Podcasts are also available. I'm Julie Burock.